Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. In ordinary times in the history of the Earth, biologists estimate about one species in every million went extinct every year. But this era when human activity is leaving its mark on virtually every habitat on the planet is no ordinary time. Today, the last of an estimated 1,000 species dies every year, and some experts fear we're approaching a tipping point beyond which we lose the ability to slow the pace of destruction. It is a deeply disturbing thought, but it's not a completely hopeless situation yet. A new documentary explores both the devastating effects of human activity on wild plant and animal populations and the brave actions of those working desperately to reverse course. Academy Award-winning filmmaker Luis Ojeda directed the new documentary Racing Extinction. It will be screened Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas events. Luis, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The film opens with a scene that many people might not believe was real if they didn't witness it. There's this fancy restaurant, and your crew got confirmation that this restaurant is selling whale sushi.
Yeah. No, we have an hour, so I'm going to set this up a little bit. It was really exciting because we had come out with the film, and this is in the summer of 2009, and then we found out about this restaurant called The Hump that was selling. We heard was selling whale meat. We went in there with a couple of operatives. We had the whale meat analyzed, did DNA samples. We sent it to NOAA, to agents at NOAA. They said, you need a chain of custody. And I said, what's that? And they said, well, you have to have one of us watching it so it can't be they said, she said kind of thing. And they said, can you do it again? And I said, oh, we're a nonprofit organization. It's expensive to do. It's like a $1,000 meal. And then they tried to get in themselves, and they couldn't get the restaurant to sell them whale meat. And then we got nominated for the Academy Award. And so I was in L.A. with the team. We were getting an accommodation from the city. And I looked around. I thought, we have the whole team here. So the run-up to the week before the Academy Awards, I was working with NOAA officials and Fish and Wildlife officials to bust this restaurant. So, but like when my wife is going to the parties with the celebrities, I said, you take the limo, you go ahead. I want to bust these, bust this restaurant.
So you're pulling out the gaffer tape and getting microphones on people, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And she said to me, why don't you grow up? And I said, I was made for this kind of stuff. This is what I live for. You go ahead and do your thing. And then we busted the restaurant. We went in on a Thursday. We won the Academy Award on a Sunday, and they raided the restaurant on a Monday. It became international news on Tuesday. So it was like this amazing sort of soaring of that the environmental movement is winning.
It's a really interesting element, I think, because it's a reminder that it's easy for all of us to think, well, three bites of dinner is not going to destroy a species. But of course, the film goes on to remind us that, all of this adds up. And individuals might not think they're responsible for this kind of destruction, but when we provide the demand, we feed this extinction chain.
Yeah, and we're starting to understand that we're all connected. We don't even like to think of ourselves as animals, but we're all connected to every animal on this planet one way or another. I mean, you might not think plankton is valuable to you. You can't see it usually with your eye. If you pick up a handful of water, seawater, but you can see plankton from space because these blooms are enormous. So these blooms are shrinking. And that should give us great pause because plankton is responsible for 2 out of every 3 breaths that you take. Some people say we're losing it at the rate of 1% a year. So, even something in the ocean that you have no relationship with is you actually have a very intimate relationship. In fact, you owe every other breath at least to it.
What suggests that we are currently living through a period of mass extinction?
Well, there's been 5 mass extinctions in the history of the planet. And like you say, 1 out of, a million should go extinct every year. And now we're seeing this great dying going on all around us. I mean, we're losing species faster than scientists' have the ability to record that they're even here on the planet with us. And when I found out about this, I was just shocked. I mean, I knew something was going on in the oceans because every time you go on a dive after a 5-year break from the Galapagos, you come back and it's like you just notice that there's less and less animals. Of course, you can't do a census underwater, but we know that we're losing the coral reefs. And the coral reefs are yet another canary in the coal mine. Previous to all the mass extinctions, the five mass extinctions in the past, we've lost the coral reefs. And that's what's going on right now through a lot of different insults, but the main one being, you know, we're heating up the coral reefs. There's a 2-degree difference in temperature can crash a reef. And when that happens, you know, you lose 25% of the species in the ocean. All coral reefs at this rate of acidification and warming will be gone by 2100. That means that, you know, when you go to the Caribbean or, you know, your favorite place to go snorkeling, that's going to be like a remnant of a bygone era. And that should give everybody pause. I mean, to me, the most beautiful thing I've ever done in my life as far as exploration goes is put my head underwater and see this incredible, you know, universe of alien creatures. And to think that that's all going, you know, it set me off on this course. That's why we did the film, because I think there's some things we can do to mitigate it.
People hear about ocean acidification and they don't necessarily know what that means. Literally, acidic ocean waters can dissolve shellfish.
Yeah, exactly. Everything with a carbonic shell on it, like, you know, coral reefs, the little things that live on them, plankton. Anything that has a carbonic shell starts to dissolve with this carbonic acid. And the way it gets there is the burning of fossil fuels. You might not believe in global warming, but you should believe in ocean acidification because it's absolutely real and it's going on right now. Every time you turn on your car, every time you heat your house with fossil fuels, every time you fly to Texas Earth Day, it's going to be having an effect on the atmosphere. And that about a half to a third of what we that goes in the atmosphere gets dissolved by the oceans, and it starts to acidify, you know, basically our life support system.
And of course, there is also the idea, you know, in a landlocked place like North Texas, it's pretty easy to feel disconnected from things. And this film sort of takes us underwater, and we start to see the kind of suffering that is also caused by our demand for resources that we can't replenish.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think whether you're, whether you live in Texas, well, certainly if you live in Texas, and there's a lot of oil and gas here as well as my state, Colorado. I mean, we're all responsible for this. That's the thing. It's like the bad guy really here is us, and we resisted the call to blame other people for this film. We wanted people to sort of feel responsible for it. And like myself in the film, I say, the worst thing you can do to the environment is make a film about it. When we started to do a carbon assessment of what it took to make that film, I was horrified. But then it started motivating me to change the way we get our energy at home. In my office where we had ops, I put up 120 solar panels. We got, we did that all the, if we finished the rest of that production on solar energy. I now produce 140% of the energy that we get from the sun. I've been driving an electric car, 2002 Toyota RAV, not a fancy car, but it's an all-electric vehicle. And it's been the license plate on it says VUS. It stands for Vehicle Using Sun. It's the opposite of an SUV. And there's nothing more empowering to me is to take energy, once you've done the infrastructure, to take energy from the sun for free and get it then into your car and drive around. I mean, that car has never been into the shop ever, for any kind of mechanical problem. There's one moving part in the engine, a rotor. That's why the car companies hate them, is because there's just, there's nothing to fix on them. They don't go, there's nothing goes wrong with them. That to me, I live in Colorado. In December in Colorado, I get checks from the electric company. It used to be where you got that envelope and you sort of like, oh, what's the bill going to be now? It's anywhere from $600 to $1,000 a month. Hmm. Now it's a check. And I go to the mailbox and I see that thing. And it's a delight to open it up because I think it's like, the lottery.
One of the places you take us in this film is the Cornell Bioacoustical Laboratory. And it turns out to be a really poignant moment in the film because there are scientists there trying to document the cries of a lot of different animals. But some that they have recorded, they're essentially recording the last known member of the species, giving mating calls to a partner who will never respond because there aren't any left.
Yeah, no, it's a heartbreaking part of the film. And one that, I've seen the film probably a couple hundred times at different iterations right now. And, you can become numb to something. But every time I feel that, it's like, even right now, it makes me, want to tear up. Because it's like a science fiction nightmare going out there for the rest of the planet. I mean, we think, humans think, well, we're okay. Yeah, we're okay. We're in a nice, you know, studio here. We can go and get, you know, water and coffee. But there's, you know, the rest of the world out there. If you have compassion for other creatures, of other beings, if you're not just worried about yourself and your family, and you're thinking about future generations, which I think is the calling of everybody to, once they get self-actualized, you have a responsibility to do something about it. And a really good filmmaker, James Cameron, who's executive producing my next film, told me there's no way you can get people to change unless you can affect their emotions. You can give them all the information you want, but until you hit their hearts, there's no way you can get them to change. And that's why we have that scene up front and early, is to get people to feel, you know, what it's like. Because it's everybody's, you know, nightmare. You know, you look at Interstellar, that film, and in Gravity. It's all about being lost in space. And what's it like to be the last animal in the world searching for a mate that'll never come?
And another thing that makes it particularly sad is that we're just beginning to understand that virtually every animal that we know communicates with sound. We may not be able to hear it with the frequency that is audible to us, but it's there.
Yeah, I was a National Geographic photographer. This is one of the really cool things that I love about the film, is that you look at the world through these eyes and these ears, and you think, well, this is all there is to see. You know, this is all you can comprehend. But what the electromagnetic spectrum is, you know, the ultraviolet light that we see, the light that we see in the electromagnetic spectrum is a very thin band. There's a guy that studies light of all different waves that's in the film. I was with him yesterday doing a talk with him in Baltimore. But he said it's like when you look at the world through these eyes, it's like you have a grand piano in your house, but you can only hear one note on it. You know, there's this band of light from, you know, ultraviolet to the very lower reaches that is, you know, impervious to human sight. And that's what's cool about this film. It's like you can – we have a camera. It's called a FLIR, a forward-looking infrared camera. And we can talk about that later, how we installed it into a James Bond vehicle. But we travel around the streets of L.A. with this, and all over the country, actually. And we have two cameras, one camera that sees what your eye sees, another camera what – the fossil fuel companies don't want you to see. And that's the world, this hidden world, this invisible world to us of greenhouse gases. And so with this camera with a very special filter on it, we can see carbon dioxide coming out of tailpipes, out of smokestacks, you know, out of methane leaking out of oil wells. And you start to see this hidden world, and you start to think, these scientists that are talking about greenhouse gases, it's no longer the boogeyman that's like, you know, invisible. You can actually see it. And then on the other side of it, you look at, you know, our ears. Our ears are like, you know, we can hear anything from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. It sounds like a lot of a big range, but like dolphins can go 10 times higher than that. And so, and a blue whale is infrasound. It's lower than we can hear. So a blue whale has the loudest song in the animal kingdom, but we can't hear it. You know, like when I'm talking right now, if you look at it on a scope, it'd be like these little hills and valleys going up very quickly. A blue whale song, you wouldn't even recognize it as a song because their metronome is so much larger than our own. Their songs, a single note can be 60 to 90 seconds long. So going through that same scope, it would be like 2 kilometers long. You wouldn't recognize, you'd see it as a straight line, but it'd actually be a part of a note that you can't comprehend. Now, what this does, the blue whale is able to communicate over oceans, because sound not only travels further than the ocean, but this low sound makes it like a fiber optic. These animals can actually communicate with each other over great distances. Some scientists say calculated that they can actually hear each other in the Southern Ocean, where there's no landmass in the way, clear around the world. These animals, the blue whale, largest animal that ever lived on the planet, has adapted itself so it can actually communicate over, you know, many thousands of miles. Now, why did it do this? Because they're not gregarious by nature. So in the Southern Ocean, where you have these krill blooms blooming and there's not that many animals, they have a system where they can actually communicate. They'll start to sing and alert the other ones where the song's coming from.
It's astonishing. We're speaking this hour with director Luis Ojoias. He is director of the documentary Racing Extinction, which will screen Saturday afternoon at 2 at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Luis Ahoyas, who is director of the new documentary Racing Extinction, which will be screened this weekend at 2 and at 6 on Saturday and Sunday at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas. We've just been joined for this second segment by the film's co-executive producer, Trammell Crowe. Trammell, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me today.
Talk about, Trammell, how you got involved in the project and decided you wanted to. I guess as co-executive producer, this is your money at work as well as your passion.
Louis came and stayed with me for a weekend. He didn't try to sell me at all. There was a companion who beat me up all weekend. We had a great time. We had a brotherhood at the end of it. And it took me, I don't know how long, a month or two of really agitating to make the investment. The primary reason, because it has such a huge educational follow-up that goes on for years, doesn't it? And the second main reason, so we could feature it in Dallas at the Earth Day Texas.
One of the things I found very powerful about the film is that you don't ignore the fact that these are complicated issues. And there's a village, is it in Indonesia, where essentially everybody's livelihood comes from hunting manta rays. And so there's an issue, like if they stop doing this, even though there is a declining population, human beings have to figure out what else to do.
Yeah, and, you know, we like to think of all the solutions to these problems as upgrades. And you know, one of the stars of our film, Sean Heinrichs, he had done this once before in a small village, Isla Mujeres in Mexico. It was the largest shark fishing village on the east coast of Mexico. And that's what they did for a living. They hunted sharks. And then he said there's a lot more money watching sharks. And now all those fishermen that used to kill them are now, you know, upgrading their boats to accommodate for tourists. And I've been down there, and it's beautiful. It's miraculous when you know, you go to dive with whale sharks and mantis. It's like, you know, it's a highlight of your life. And the fishermen too are now understanding. Like, yeah. There's not just a lot of money in it, but the fallout from it for the village. You know, there's more restaurant service. There's, you know, they're able to send their kids to better schools. I mean, it's a better life all the way around. We're trying to do the same thing in this little town in Indonesia called Lamakara. And Sean was just there 2 days ago, and you know, I wish I could report. There's a few houses that are converting over to bed and breakfasts. This is the very, you know, beginning of an industry there. But, you know, he photographed a fin whale on the beach along with a baby manta, you know, that they have been in the, you know, they said, well, we still need to feed our families. So we're rushing to do the same model over there. Not that every village in the world can, you know, revert to ecotourism, but at least it's one solution.
I want to talk about the demand for shark fins, which people may or may not be aware are something that is highly prized in China. And even more disturbing maybe than the fact that these animals are being caught in large numbers is the fact that it's not even like the whole shark is used. They are essentially – it's like vivisection, and a living shark is thrown back into the water to die.
Yeah, exactly. And Sean Heinrichs, again, he's one of our stars of the film. You know, he – photographed this being done about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago or so, where, you know, a little tawny reef shark with fin cutting off. He saw it living on the reef trying to swim. Sharks have to swim, and they certainly need fins. And but this one video, in conjunction with Wild A, this is one of our partners, they did a video that was seen by, I think it was nearly a billion people in Asia. And that one video is responsible for, you know, some people say 80 to 50% of the demand being decreased in China alone just by this one video that they released. So that's another one of the tenets of our film, is that there's a lot of power in the visuals of people seeing something like this. And, you know, I mean, I was a photographer for National Geographic. I've seen what you know, work can do. Back in 1983, the first story I did for them was a story on garbage. And there was only one mandatory recycling program in America. And I proposed a story to them called Urban Ore. And because I saw what people were throwing away, and it was just, you know, and I've been to you, see, you look at foreign countries, and they have, you know, guards at the dumps with machine guns to, you know, so people
there's
don't
good
sell
stuff in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't steal their garbage. And, you know, I was on the vanguard of something that was very unpopular, and it became very popular. Now there's recycling under every desk almost in America. And I could see how imagery – that story became a cover story in about 35 inside pages. And I could see how it started this talk, the thinking, you know, rearranged the way people think about garbage. And now it's not seen like that.
You've learned a trick or two – this is a bit of an aside – but about how to get a camera into places where you're not supposed to have one. One of which is having a camera hanging around somebody's neck that looks as if it has to be held up to the eye to be used, but can, of course, be recording the whole time.
Yeah, you're giving away our tricks. Yeah.
Well, you give them away in the film. I'm not giving away any trade secrets here. But I thought that was so clever, and the things you're able to capture are pretty astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, we learned that from the first film I did, The Cove, where we set these hidden cameras in this this place where they kill more dolphins than any place in the world. And, you know, if those people had talked to us, we would have had an interview like this, but they wouldn't do that. So then we decided to, you know, go into with these hidden cameras. And what we came back with was stuff that you couldn't write. You know, that was amazing. When we started to get the transcripts back from what these fishermen were saying that were killing the dolphins, it was like, oh, my God, I'm so glad we didn't get an interview because this is so much better. So we use the same techniques pretty much in China, where we go in with hidden cameras and, you know, just these little – you know, the cameras are so small now. I mean, you can put them in, the hole of a button. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this guy that we get these cameras from, he's like, Q from Bond. You know, he puts them in the candy bars for us and water bottles. And it's like, you know, it's just fun to see him go at work to try to figure out how can you sneak a camera into a place where people don't want cameras.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking with the director and co-executive producer of the new film Racing Extinction. It's a documentary that will be screened Saturday and Sunday as part of Earth Day Texas events. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Toby in Richardson. Hello, Toby.
Hi. First, I want to say that nobody in my family has ever eaten whale. We only stick with soy whale. quick question. I live in Richardson, and years ago, we stopped using heating in the winter and air conditioning in the summer, and the water is no longer heated because we don't like dealing with the Atmos Gas Company, and we've gotten used to it. And I think it saved a lot, not only a lot of money, but hopefully helped the environment. But the question is, if you live in Richardson and we take DART now, we also don't drive because we think that's very bad for the environment, and you park your car in your driveway, even if it's all spick and span and nice looking, they will actually threaten you and give you a citation and drag you to court if you don't use your car. And I'm wondering what advice your guests would have for people who are trying to do things and be responsible and help the environment, but they have city governments that are actively trying to discourage people from helping the environment.
I wasn't aware of that, but that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of that either. I mean, there's a lot of power in getting together. I mean, in my own community back in Boulder, Colorado, we're going to be one of the first communities probably in the United States to win back control of their energy company purely for environmental reasons. You know, people in Boulder, Colorado, they're pretty evolved with education and with the environment. They'd rather pay higher prices than to pollute the environment. And we're not satisfied with what the local energy provider is doing. So we want to speed it up by taking control ourselves. So, I mean, when I started to get involved in this issue, I just found, you know, compatriots. And you can never underestimate the power of a single voice. I mean, everybody, you know, that the message of our film, when you see what Sean Heinrichs is able to do, that one person with that one picture and one camera was able to basically change the world. I mean, everybody has that ability. You know, he's an amazing photographer and documentarian, but everybody has a gift somehow. You know, they can – whatever that caller's, you know, gift is. I mean, he probably has his own – I assume he's not the first person that he's told this to. But there's a lot of power in coming together. And that's, you know, and trying to, you know, change the laws. You know, the politicians should be scared of us, not the other way around. And that's what we hope to do with this film, is to get people galvanized so they understand that we're all in this together. It's not about the right or the left. It's about us coming together to push the politicians to do the right thing.
Would you agree with that, Trammell Crowe, that we have maybe made a mistake in framing issues like environmental conservation as liberal issues, that things that maybe are only appealing to a segment of the population?
Exactly right. In fact, that's kind of the distinguishing characteristic of Earth Day Texas. I'm a Republican personally. I look at issues independently, but nearly always wind up voting that way, which is very ironic because the Republican elected officials in Texas are almost inimical to the environment categorically.
Why do you think that's the case?
The Republican Party has forgotten its mission. Abraham Lincoln did something with land conservation. Teddy Roosevelt started the National Park Service. To conservation is conservative. It used to be a truism that we've really forgotten. Perhaps in the 60s, the confrontational aspects of the original Earth Days, which viewed large corporations as the polluters and the enemies, today they are the innovators, also the polluters. The way I see it is consumers and corporations make the problems themselves, but usually it's the corporations that have to lead us out of them. So it's not only becoming political, but voting with your dollars. But the point Louis made so well, we should not be afraid of the politicians. They should be afraid of us. We have a petition booth and a voting registration booth at Earth Day. I urge people to vote for their city councilman. And Denton, Azle, and Reno with the fracked problems going on now, and the state reps and state legislators, writing the politicians and calling them is very effective.
That is an interesting thing to think about, because many people, as our caller expressed, are trying to do the right thing personally. But I guess it's hard, you know, here and there to have people deciding that they're going to make these changes if we don't sort of have a broader societal move to do things differently.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, everything that we're doing pretty much is wrong. You know, when you look at the world through these gas cams like I have, you think, okay, this is a problem. But, you know, I'm used to being on that cutting edge of, you know, being a little bit the abrasive one, the one to help show the way. I mean, that's kind of what you do as a journalist. You try to open up that door. And, you know, we don't have all the solutions by any stretch of the imagination, but we have, you know, access to what lets you see the problem and feel the problem. And then, you know, hopefully other people will get together and manage this, you know, that issue. When we did the first film, The Cove, you know, we did this film that I made in my backyard. Then all of a sudden, it's like people are asking, "What can I do?" And it's like, "Oh my God, we don't have an educational campaign." Luckily, that got picked up by Jeff Scholl's organization, Participant. With this one, we started very early, 2.5 years ago. We started working with Paul Allen's group, Vulcan Media. Paul Allen is the, you know, he has a football team. That's the pointy ball.
Thank you.
He's a co-founder of Microsoft, but he's working on the his company's working on the educational campaign for this film with us. So if you go to racingextinction.com, you can, you know, get involved. But that campaign will develop as we go along. I mean, right here in the state of Texas, we're working on a bill, I think it's 1579, which is going to ban the trade of shark fins. It just got passed by the House, I think, yesterday. Recently, and it's going to the Senate now. So you can, you know, call your local senator and get involved by saying we don't want, you know, shark fins to be, you know, sold or traded in the state.
There's an interesting scene in the film about the retrofitting of the Empire State Building, which, of course, is this like symbol of American business and capitalism. You know, we build buildings to be efficient in a different way in 2015 than we did in 1934 or whatever it was, 31, when it was completed. Talk about why you felt it was important to include this. You know, some people might say, well, it's still not a shining example of the best that we can do.
No, but it's a symbol of here you take one of the oldest but most iconic buildings, which was an energy suck, and you made it into an energy saving thing. Tony Malkin, who owned the building with a consortium of others, now it's had an IPO and it's a public building, but he's still in charge of it. He did a $500 million refit. Only about 20 some million of it was done to green it. And what he found out was, this is really cool, he saves $4.5 million a year on energy because of that 20 some million dollars, but he's able to triple the rents. Because the building's a lot more comfortable to be in. The person that's, you know, the most powerful in the corner office was always warm while everybody else was freezing. And then when the sun went around the other side of the building, it reversed where, you know, he was always comfortable, but these other people would be too hot. Now people are spending 16% more time there. And the people that run the companies know that because it's more you know, comfortable for their employees to be there, tripling the rent, he's able to, you know, his revenue goes up a lot. You know, you're talking about a, you know, one of the largest, still one of the largest buildings in New York. And there's another reason we did that too, is because we're still, we have in the works, we want to project. The film's done. You know, we're showing it at Day Texas as a film that was good enough to be in Sundance, but we still want to do this projections on the Empire State Building. And, you know, for the viewers out there that most of them haven't seen the film, we end this the film with this big projection event on the United Nations. But we want to add one more where we do these endangered species on the Empire State Building. So imagine having like a, you know, a primate, like a golden lion tamarin, 1,000 feet tall in the Empire State Building. Everybody will know about endangered species because it'll be, you know, your feed, your, you know, Facebook feed and Twitter and, you know, Instagram feeds are going to be filled up with these images, beautiful images of endangered species on the Empire State Building, which is what we want to do. So that, we, you know, we'll bookend that in the film.
And these projections happen, and there are some facts as well about what's happening. And what you show, in addition to the projections on buildings, is people responding to this. And it's it seems very powerful.
Yeah, no, I mean, we did it was really amazing. This is, you know, the day before the big climate march in September, last September, Ban Ki-moon let us basically take over, you know, the entire UN building, which is like a building I drew as a kid. So now to, you know, to have like, you know, the equivalent of like, you know, 10 IMAX screens on the side of the General Assembly building and then the Secretariat building, you know, 39 stories tall, to take over those surfaces and basically – you know, use them to give endangered species a voice was just beautiful. So people came from all over New York. We had to sort of limit the crowds because we got too big. The cops said the police said they'd shut us down. But it was an amazing event. It was just so heartwarming because people, you know, you have this. Sometimes it feels like a conceit to feel like somebody else will feel the same thing that you're feeling if they see the information or feel the information. But what I've come to realize is that if I feel something on film, other people will too. And yeah, people responded in the streets. New Yorkers, hardcore New Yorkers, were you know, crying and cheering on the streets. It was an exciting event.
And we should say you can also project these images onto steam emissions from processing plants, fuel processing plants.
Yeah, exactly. One thing we did, maybe in the next segment we talk about a little bit, but you know, the mobile projection vehicle.
We'll talk about that in just a moment with director Luis Sahoyas. His film is called Racing Extinction. We have the film's co-executive producer with us as well, Trammell Crowe. It will be screened, the film, on Saturday and Sunday at both 2 and 6 at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas events. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. A little bit of housekeeping here. We will be doing this show all next week, but we will be doing it not from our studios here in North Texas, but from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. We have a very special week planned for you in the nation's capital. We hope you will listen then. You can find details about the guests we'll be speaking to online on the Think page at kera.org. And of course, if you have a question for any of the guests we have lined up, you can send that to think@kera.org. Or you can get in touch with me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Back to the conversation of the hour. Today, of course, is Earth Day, April 22nd, and we are speaking this hour with Academy Award-winning director Luis Sahoyas and co-executive producer Trammell Crowe of the new documentary Racing Extinction. It will be screening both days this weekend at 2 and 6 at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Louis, you alluded before the break to the mobile screening vehicle. Let's talk about this thing. This is a specially tricked out Tesla electric vehicle, and it does something very special.
Well, it does a lot of things very special. It's like a Bond vehicle. You know, one of the reporters, you know, saw the last film and said it was like a cross between The Bourne Identity and Flipper. This one's this one's a little bit more like, you know, it's a result of watching too many Jacques Cousteau movies and James Bond movies as a kid. I always wanted a Bond car, but like if you ever see a real Bond car, everything's fake. The machine guns are fake, all this. We wanted something that was really cool but for the environment. So we took a Tesla. We paid full price for it, but we ripped out the interior. And in the back, we put a 16,000 lumen projector on a robotic arm so it comes out of the hatch and we can project like IMAX-sized images onto the big buildings. And out of the front, we have one of those cameras I talked about in the first section where it's a forward-looking infrared camera that can see these greenhouse gases. So we can project those greenhouse gases in real time. It's the first car in the world to have an electroluminescent paint job, so we can actually change the color of the car with a flick of a button. You know, it's disappearing license plates and all those gadgets. But it's fast. And we have a Leilani Munter, who's a NASCAR driver. She basically uses her car to talk about environmental messages. All her cars are like on for the environment. She did a Cove car, a Blackfish car. Solar cars, and she's a big proponent of green energy. So she drives the car, she helms the thing. I'm a little bit too scared to drive it because we made it too expensive to drive. But it's a cool vehicle. So we've been going around Dallas the last few nights, just projecting on various buildings and stuff. We're going out again tonight if it doesn't rain.
Can you tell people where you'll be?
No.
All right, we will leave that up to chance, and good luck if people find it, and of course the weather. We hope that will work out for you. Let's go to the phones now. We have Jack on the line in Denton. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Chris. Good afternoon to you and your guests. Just Hi. Calling in regard to the fracking vote in Denton. We wish the politicians would fear us, but our own representative, Myra Crownover, even defied her constituents, not only supported the House bill, but wrote the wording, amendments to it. And I think the only thing they fear is losing the money that lines their pockets. And until the politicians do fear us, they're there to negate what we're doing here.
Have you followed, Trimble, the fight against fracking among some residents of Denton County?
Yes, I have. I've spoken to Frack Dallas, Frack Free Denton, other organizations that have stage time at the Earth Day. And from the most reliable studies that I've read, if 100% perfectly done with no accidents or anything wrong, the most recent studies that environmental groups have seemed to have approved, if you will, indicate that fracking doesn't taint water tables, but it's hard for me to think about that when I hear stories about people who have had their faucets flaming or have had fracking companies move onto the property without even warning them and taking over half of their farm for fracking activities. I do believe that the Groundroots organizations like Frack Free Denton are really effective. If they'll just vote, they will out those people next time.
So we've talked in this hour about global warming. We've talked about ocean acidification, overfishing, and species depletion. We have talked about many things. And one point that is made in the film, Louis, is that we really are not in a position to put these in a list of priorities and attack one first, and then once that's fixed, get to the next one. People really need to sort of grab what they're passionate about and start trying to make a change.
Yeah, I mean, I started in the environmental movement back in about 1975. I was, with Pete Seeger protesting nuclear power plants back, a long time ago. So, and he said, I remember he told me, he said, it's like the environmental movement is like we're trying to all push a log up a hill, and everybody's, pushing on a different part of it. And there's always people saying, oh, push over here. We need more, people over here. But it says if you keep on pushing, eventually the log gets up the hill. And that's the analogy I would use here. It's like, find out what you're passionate about. Find out, where you can be effective and what makes you feel good. And work there. That's the way forward.
Back to the phones now. Let's speak with Angela in Dallas. Hi, Angela.
Hi. I totally agree with that point as far as, feel what you're passionate about. A couple of friends and I decided to protest against the trophy hunters with the Dallas Fire Club. This January and last January, when it came to the rhino against in Namibia, with Corey Knowlton, and then also this last January with the elephant in Cameroon. And so we protested because we feel like that's completely against conservation because, you know, the elephants and rhinos and some of the other species like lions don't need another bullet. They need more protection. And so I just wanted to get your stance on that. Like, how do you feel about trophy hunting?
Thanks for your call.
Well, I'm not a, you know, I would say I was never a hunter, but I mean, I hunted fish. I mean, I'm sorry to say. And now I'm a, you know, I've been a vegan for about the last 6 years. But I don't think in this day and age, I know there's a lot of hunters in Texas. I don't think we need to be hunting lions and giraffes, which is what, you know, on my feed now, and certainly rhinoceroses. I mean, that's, I don't think there's anything. I think that should be banned completely. A lot of these, you know, there's more. There's more tigers in Texas than in the wild right now, is what I'm told. About 2,500, 3,000 in the wild, and there's more in captivity here in Texas. I don't think we need to be raising wild animals for entertainment or for hunting. I mean, that's just, you know, I think we've evolved beyond past that.
Do you believe it's possible to ethically eat meat and consume animal products?
No, I think to be an environmentalist, it'd be very difficult. If you saw the greenhouse gases behind a hamburger, that you could eat it. A good friend of mine that just died recently, Sam Simon, creator of The Simpsons, told me that a vegetarian driving a Hummer uses less energy than a meat eater on a bicycle.
Wow.
I mean, you know, the average a burger uses, you know, 5,000 pounds of or 5,000 gallons of water. You know, about 18% of the greenhouse gases are caused to raise feed for animals that we're going to then eat. It's, you know, in the transportation sector accounts for about 14%. So, you know, the biggest effect somebody can make on the environment is adopting a plant-based diet.
Of course, we're hearing pushback now from people who, you know, have been touting this new figure that it takes a gallon of water to raise one almond.
Yeah, well, that's true, but it's still less than a hamburger is for protein. And by the way, the protein from an almond is going to be a lot better for you in the long run than a burger, by far. So, yeah, but, you know, I've certainly, you know, changed my, you know, that you know, alfalfa, you know, that's one of the biggest culprits out west, you know, where water is, you know, they're going through this amazing drought. And they're basically exporting, you know, their water through alfalfa that's being used to raise cows in China. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't do this sort of global assessment of where our energy is really coming from. And if you start to make choices based on that, you start to, you know, to change the way you consume things. And certainly diet. You can save the environment three times a day, you know, by deciding to eat a more plant-based diet.
Tremel, what do you say to people who say there is no conservative case for limiting free enterprise, even if it's going to be good for the environment? If it's bad for business, it can't be conservative.
I'd say poppycock. We don't live in a pure capitalist society. Anybody who advocates that is living in la-la land like some libertarian. We live in a mixed economy. We have to have regulation of all types. And anybody who looked at it seriously would agree that unharnessed capitalism is fatal to animals and people.
How effective has the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species been in trying to get a handle on watching out for the plants and animals, I guess animals, that are in the most danger?
Yeah, well, they're effective. You know, it gives some teeth. It's the only organization that we really have to protect endangered species internationally. So getting, you know, an animal on that list certainly helps. But, you know, then you have to enforce it locally. Like, in China, we found this guy that was selling, you know, oil from three protected the only three protected species of sharks that there were. And he was doing it, you know, without any fear of being arrested until we went in with these undercover cameras. And we shut down six out of the seven processing plants in that town. But he's still thrives because he has government protection. But I don't know, you just keep on pushing, you know, it's like you have to work at every angle you can. It has to be on the international regulation level, it has to be on the local level, and it has to be on the personal level. Make it difficult for these people to do work locally.
What's the best way to address the demand issue? If people still want to buy shark fins and manta rays and other endangered species, how do we stop them from wanting it?
Well, you know, I hate to say it, but in China, it was just shaming. You know, it was just if people start to see how these animals are killed for the shark fin soup and they give them that information, then anybody else that does it feels a little bit like, you know, they become ostracized. And that's what happened in China. You know, now it's banned from, you know, it used to be part of every government ceremony. I went to China many times and they served, you know, shark fin soup. Now it's illegal. A politician would go to jail if he was at a banquet and served up shark fin soup. So this has happened in just the last couple of years. You know, change can happen really quick. And then even quicker now than when I started in this business, you know, 40 years ago, you know, because every kid with a laptop has as much power as a, you know, writer for the New York Times does now. You know, things can go viral. You can get, you know, viral used to be 10 million. Now it's 100 million. You know, kids, you know, have an incredible amount of power with, you know, showing what's going on. I've got great faith. When we show this film to, you know, to college groups and to high school kids, it was just like, you know, usually at an adult screen, you'll see like a half a dozen hands go up for the Q&A. We showed it at Sundance for a group of kids, about 430 kids. About a third of the audience's hands came up, and I was like, oh my God. This is our market here. And we showed it for 1,700 inner-city school kids in D.C., and it was the same response. It was like, oh, my God, this is our market. These kids know. This is, you know, this is their earth that we've, you know, somebody my age, you know, basically helped ruin. And now it's up to these kids to pick up the pieces. And they get it. They see what they're losing because they have their whole life ahead of them.
Tremel, final thoughts on how we keep Earth Day from being a thing that people think about once a year and feel really good about and then move on to whatever, planning their summer vacation?
Well, you forced me once again to talk about Earth Day, Texas.
Yes, I know. I'm twisting your arm to talk about this.
What really riled me and maybe propelled us into starting this group effort was that Earth Days are just concerts, rock and roll concerts. People go home at the end. Or street parties. Speakers, conferences, exhibition. To me, it's exhibition and demonstration. Instead of celebrating Mother Earth, studying and vowing to do some things about it.
We have spoken this hour with Tremel Crowe, who is co-executive producer of the new film Racing Extinction. Its director, Luis Ojoyes, is here as well. He is an Academy Award-winning filmmaker. The documentary will be screened Saturday and Sunday afternoons at 2 and 6 o'clock at the Music Hall at Fair Park as part of Earth Day Texas. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure to have both of you here.
Likewise. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Want to remind both of you that Think Again will be in Washington, D.C. next week. We hope that you will be listening all week and participating. As always on the show, you will continue to have your chances to call in, to write in, to tweet in. But instead of sitting here in our studios, the crew that makes the show will be at NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can learn more about the trip and send questions along when you go to the Think page at KERA.org. We hope to see you then, and we hope you will enjoy what we have planned. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show, send those questions for next week via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.